Hello and welcome to yet another edition of Editing Aloud. And panel, we've had quite a week in South Africa so far. Nelson Mandela Centenary, and we had a magnificent event in Johannesburg yesterday where former US President Barack Obama gave a long and probably his most public speech since leaving the White House in the beginning of 2017. And he had a few sharp sort of messages for the world, and I suspect also for an American audience back home about Donald Trump. Ray, you were there. What did you think of it?
I thought it was a very good speech. I thought it was very clever. It was masterful. It was like a symphony. It built up. You know, he's an orator. What was interesting for me was how South Africans received it, because you had the great and good of Johannesburg. You know, yeah. The good folk were out in their fine clothing. Yeah. 15,000 of them, and they cheered this on, and you suddenly realize that if you look past all the Twitter trolls and the rubbish that gets spoken by little parties trying to get attention, most South Africans actually are one
heart.
With the idea of a kinder, gentler capitalism that is more friendly, that of sorting out poverty, of being fair, of businesses not being so rapaciously greedy.
Yeah.
You know, these messages really went home really well with this audience.
Yeah.
As did Ramaphosa. The last time that Obama spoke was at Mandela's memorial in Soweto.
Yeah.
And there Jacob Zuma was booed. The mood was awful. You just were not proud
and
to be
yesterday, Ramaphosa's reception was
rapturous. Yeah. He got two standing ovations.
Yeah.
You know, there's no question that
the event was by invitation, though, wasn't it? I mean, could you
buy tickets.
You could buy a ticket to get in.
Yeah.
I don't know, what did you think of it, Sikonathi? Did you watch?
You see, the some of us have to work. We were sitting at the desk really trying to put the financial wheels together. We didn't even watch the World Cup. However, the snippets that we did get and what Ray did indeed send to the less fortunate amongst us, it was a really great speech.
Yeah.
He had quite a few messages. Not only for Donald Trump, by the way, when he was talking about facts, the denialism of facts, he was also talking about one gentleman who was in the audience, not far away from him, a guy called Thabo Mbeki. The denialism of facts. Think AIDS, think HIV.
Was Thabo Mbeki there?
I did see quite a few
I didn't hear Mbeki, Cyril acknowledge
I know that Motlanthe was there and he was acknowledged, but I
don't
think
Mbeki
was there.
Oh, well, I probably
There was also a reference to people, politicians who hold press conferences and say nothing, which I thought reminded me of a certain political party.
I'm quite happy to acknowledge that I was working producing this great magazine called
Absolutely.
The Financial Way, and I saw
that's a very fine edition of the FM.
A picture
this
or
week.
Two. But there really was a nice message about inclusive capitalism.
Yeah.
And why can't we have politicians?
Yeah.
Who speak like that, who think like that,
yeah.
who have a vision.
You don't think it's predictable? I mean, I expected that of Obama. I expected it to be exactly what it was. I mean, the message of softer capitalism is a good one, and I think the Americans took from it what they wanted to see.
Mm.
But I found it to be exactly what you'd expect of Obama. It was kind of predictable, but it was still great. I mean, I thought he spoke really well.
It's basically a kind of kind liberalism in a way,
yeah.
especially with regard to capitalism. I mean, I enjoyed it because that's my thing, is inclusive growth and inclusive capitalism, and I've been going on about it for years. I'm very glad to see myself repeated
but
by so illustrious a leader.
I felt like a part of it was inequality. I mean, that was one of the key messages was inequality. And you come to a country like this where our Gini coefficient is ridiculous. We have 36.7% of people out of work. I think the it's far more glaring, perhaps, for someone like an American, where they have 4% unemployment now, to come here and see this many people out of work. And the inequality at such ridiculous levels because so many people are out of work.
I have a thing. Let's talk about inequality and poverty. I mean, they're different things, aren't they? They have different causes. I mean, inequality is caused by the presence of money. And poverty is caused by the absence of money. I mean, so they have different solutions. And I just wonder whether we concentrate too much on inequality rather than on poverty, which is where I would have thought the real problem is, I mean, if you took the 20 richest people out of this equation in South Africa, what would that do to the Gini coefficient?
Yeah, that is true. It would. But I mean, I was at a meeting with some Reserve Bank people recently, and they said the issue isn't the people who earn, you know, 20 million rand a year and the people who earn sort of 100,000 rand a year. It's the fact that the Gini coefficient is completely skewed by the fact that there's so many people out of work, which makes it look far worse than America, for example. But I mean, the other issue is that poverty has completely different dimensions to inequality. I mean, that Human Resources Council stat last week that said that 64% of black people are living in poverty and 1% of white people, which is just a racially skewed metric that is illustrates how completely volatile this country is and why race is such a critical thing to discuss now.
And the biggest mistake we, the people of South Africa, have made over the years, we've actually made poverty acceptable. The fact that there's that
we
number
get much
of
more
people,
excited about inequality.
Exactly, and we have made poverty an acceptable fact of life. Really, you get out of here, you see people who live on zero rent per month, the income, the absence of the income that Rob is talking about. Mm. And it's a crisis if you have 37% unemployment rate, the real unemployment rate. You have the 64% of black people, many of them young people who have the ability to cause massive, to destabilize this social order, untold amount of damage to the economy. But we all sit here in our high chairs and think poverty is acceptable. We see people earning, having to live on 1,600 rands a month, and we do nothing about it.
That would be, 1,600 rand would be a hell of a lot more than the people I was watching on television last night.
It's more than zero.
In a village, you couldn't call it a village, a collection of basically rondavels and huts, not too far from Mthatha. And they had to walk about 3 or 4 kilometers to a little stream to get water, which was heavily polluted. Some NGO had gone and done tests on the water. It was full of E. coli. And there was no way to treat it, and these were very old women. I mean, you know, who had no hope of getting clean water, no hope of getting anybody to help them. There was a guy with a bucky who would drive them there, but it would charge them. And he said, you know, I have to charge them because one, fuel is expensive, and two, this road is so bad it breaks my car when I bring it down here. But it's the only way to get 100 liters of water back up to the hill. You know, for these old women who need to cook with it, wash themselves with it. It was appalling for 2018 that the ANC, the government, hasn't helped those people.
And there's absolutely no sense of urgency. That is the
it's
crisis
because they're hidden.
Facing this country. They are not at all hidden, Peter. We come from those people. I am of those people.
Yeah.
All of those people, the government that you are talking about, is of those people. They come from there, up the ladder, kick it down, and no one climbs.
Yeah.
That's the reality.
What Barack Obama said yesterday is that, you talk about inclusive growth, is that socialism isn't the answer to fix that. I mean, you need a market-led, a softer, different kind of capitalism. But
well, you need to give people a stake
approach
in the economy somehow.
Exactly.
You know, land would do that. I was interested to listen to Cyril on the interview he gave the day before, talking about using the expropriation of land, which was going to be as a growth opportunity. And if you think about it, if you are able to expropriate the right pieces of land near the right cities and all that, you can build new cities or new suburbs, you know, and which just in building them you generate economic growth. So he seems to be a lot more comfortable than the polls would suggest, or the reports would suggest, does Ramaphosa. He was very comfortable, obviously, yesterday.
Yeah, I think, you know, this was Ramaphosa's heartland.
Mm.
Gauteng, the, you know, middle-class constituency.
Where you had to buy a ticket.
And he, you know, he just was in his zone.
Yeah.
You know, you got two standing ovations.
It
was, they agreed with everything he did. They laughed at all his jokes.
Yeah.
They laughed even when he was... camera showed him smiling on the screen. Yeah. And I think that, you know, you do have to sort of temper this with the knowledge that out there,
temper the pessimism,
you know, this is a little bit of a bubble in a country that has very, very, very
But also we can overdo the pessimism about him. I mean, Ipsos has just produced its annual, the first of its two polls of the year, and I don't have it in front of me, but if I remember correctly, it has the ANC standing at 60%, the DA at 13%, and the EFF at 7%. Now, the poll has been criticized because it probably underestimates all of the parties. But even if it underestimates by double, let's say the EFF, that still puts the EFF at around 11% or 12%. Mm. The DA, we suspect, is going to slip a little bit because of its own leadership problems. But the ANC sitting there at 60%, and you know, the analysts are saying it's an underestimation.
Yeah, I think that
so you've got nothing to worry about.
The slogan is, "Ignore the trolls, look at the polls."
Yeah,
you know. There has been criticism of that poll, and it could possibly overestimate the support because the methodology has been in some detail criticized. Front page of Business Day today,
there's
an analyst doing that. But nonetheless, even the critics agree that the broad strokes are right, and they show that the ANC is clawing back a lot of ground from the DA, in the Western Cape even,
which
in the Western Cape was it said that the DA would drop below control.
Yeah.
In the Ipsos.
Yeah,
this is very, very significant. You know, the real costs of the way in which the DA has managed its internal affairs in the Western Cape, the fact of Delisle's popularity with the base, and the symbolism of her being shafted, I think they've very much underestimated this, the political impact of it.
Yeah. The Sukhanati, what did you think of the poll? I mean, let's say the ANC is untroubled by the vote now. I mean, he's not going to get 75% or 66%, but he might get 58% or 61%.
As opposed to about 52%.
As opposed to 52 or 49.
That's absolutely accurate. I mean, the biggest campaigner for the ANC at this point is the Democratic Alliance. Mm. The wheels have really turned very fast. The ANC president before Cyril Ramaphosa was the biggest campaigner for the Democratic Alliance. Now you've got the exact opposite, where the leadership of the Democratic Alliance is the biggest campaigner for the ANC, and that's what they are doing in the Western Cape by Patricia de Lille imposing Natasha Mazone, and in the Eastern Cape there's another mess there.
Yeah.
So, well done, DA. Thank you very much. I would say if I was an ANC campaigner.
Well, one of the things the poll does say is that a lot of undecided, or what they call I can't remember what it was now. The word used was
animist.
I think that group of about 10% was either undecided 15, or it was quite large. So I think that swung it hugely. But
I think what you know, you've got to take that undecided vote and then look at it, break it down demographically, and reallocate it according to where it's most likely to eventually reside.
I mean, the highest number of undecided seem to be in the Western Cape. So. The analyst quoted in today's story, who's very good, Davy Scholtz, he said that most of those people probably drift back to the DA if they get their act together. But I did notice yesterday Patricia was at the lecture, sitting not too far away from some ANC leaders who were very happy.
She's probably charged tomorrow for appearing in a photograph with Cyril Ramaphosa.
Well, she was, yes, and she did too. She was there with Lindiwe Mazibuko, but I do suspect that she was also in a photograph along with Cyril and Barack Obama, yeah. Okay, well, we'll be back just after this break. Welcome back. Sukhanati, you've been part of the coverage in Business Day recently about the PIC and the apparent growing isolation of Dr. Dan Machila, the CEO or COO, if he has both jobs. Is he in trouble?
That is one confusing story. He is in trouble and he is not in trouble. Mm. The chairman of the board of the PIC is the Deputy Minister of Finance. Right. And the chairman said, "I'm not opposing the UDM's application to suspend Daniel Machila because I do not believe, I cannot vouch for the board of the PIC, the processes it went through during Malusi Gigaba's time as finance minister, when Daniel Machela seemed to get into trouble. They probed him, there were allegations of financial impropriety.
There was a girlfriend
with an alleged girlfriend of his. Yeah. Apparently, he influenced, gave away the PIC's money, 21 million rand of it, and got an investee company to give her another 300,000 rands. Machela denies all of this. The board last year investigated and then cleared her. And Mondli Kungubele comes up and says, I don't trust you guys, this board, therefore I'm not opposing the application. No. So you have a situation where the board of the PIC goes against its chairman, or the chairman of the PIC goes against his board. So there's two separate entities. There's the chairman and there's the board. Then the finance minister, who is the boss of the deputy minister, says, hell no, we are not suspending Daniel Machela. I am opposing this. You would seem the person that is most isolated now is the deputy finance minister, who is the chairman of the board of the Public Investment Corporation.
He's quite a good guy, Mondli Gungubele, isn't he? Is he not? He's got a good reputation.
He really is a good guy.
Ethically solid?
Absolutely. Ethically solid. He seems to have a problem with the policies that were followed by the board, and while he acknowledges in the affidavit that the majority view of the board carries the day, he's basically descending and say, they can have their own way as the majority. I, as the minister, I'm not part of this. He says, I cannot in good conscience tell this.
And does it just centre around this one transaction that Dr. Dan did, or is it, you know, is there a wider history?
The history is quite long. You know, the PIC has got 2 trillion rand of cash that all politicians want to lay their hands on. And the PIC indeed has made bad decisions in the past, which have made it vulnerable to these kinds of attacks. This comes from a particular time when Sifiso Buthelezi was chairman of the PIC, together with Malusi Gigaba as the minister.
Yeah.
And there were these allegations that came anonymously and said, Daniel Machela has given away the PIC's money, 21 million rand. He denies giving away, the company did receive the loan from the PIC. However, he denies being his personal decision. He also denies any romantic involvement.
But what interests me, Rob, is that at some stage, Nhlanhla Nene must also have been chairman of the PRC, and that for quite a long time. He was deputy finance minister for a long time, so he must know Dan Machela pretty well.
Yeah.
And he would have been there at the time, if I'm not mistaken, that the chief investment officer was fired.
The chief executive was fired.
Dan was chief investment officer.
Yes, Elias Masilela handed his resignation letter to Nhlanhla Nene.
And why did he resign?
Nhlanhla Nene has never told us. Yeah. Elias Masilela has never told us. The PAC has never told us.
It would have been under Nhlanhla Nene then that Dan Machela became chief investment officer and chief executive. So he's given him all the power.
He was already chief investment officer when Nhlanhla Nene became deputy finance minister.
Right.
It was Nhlanhla Nene that promoted him to chief.
In other words,
executive
to hold
officer.
Both jobs.
Yeah, when Elias Masilela resigned immediately, there was no notice, nothing. There was a dispute about certain transactions, and he walked, and Machela got the job.
And was the dispute in question about the loans made to Iqbal Servo to buy the Independent Group?
We now would be veering into a speculative territory.
The PSC has done a lot of suspicious loans. I mean, the Independent Group loan was just one of them.
Yeah.
And if you look at the media industry, you'd have to say it's in a tough place, Huffington Post closing down. But that was under Nhlanhla Nene when those loans were made. So that is...
So these people have all got a history with each other, is what I'm trying to say, really. I mean, and I guess it's up to people like Sikonathi over here to unravel it and find out.
There's a very long history. Look, Jacob Zuma appointed, or rather a finance minister under Jacob Zuma, and that finance minister was Pravin Gordhan, appointed Elias Masilela as chief executive.
Yeah.
Dan Machela was already chief investment officer under Brian Molefe back then. He's been there since 2003.
Right.
Now, Elias Masilela and Jacob Zuma used to live at number 43 Trelawney Park in Swaziland, in Manzini, which was Elias's home when they were in exile. So there's a very long history going on.
Yeah.
When Jacob Zuma became president, Elias Masilela became chief executive, they did the independent deal, they did indeed the Times Media deal, they did Kamak Energy, which is the that shady operation yeah. that has now been liquidated in Texas. A guy who donated Luan, he donated millions to the Jacob Zuma Foundation. In return, the PIC gave him a loan of 3 billion rand, and all that money is gone. Those were the many decisions that the PIC made that made it vulnerable to politics. And of course, there are many more. Hence, Malusi Kigaba insisted last year, before he could be accused of anything, that they should publish the list of their unlisted yeah. investments.
Yeah.
But I think as well, I mean, the situation with VBS Bank, that collapsed, where they found out that the two PRC representatives, and Sekonati did quite an extensive piece on that, the two executives from the PRC who were on the VBS board in charge of looking after this investment were themselves highly compromised with huge loans from the bank and had allowed this massive epic fraud.
Yeah.
And it's literally a theft of a bank. 75% of the bank was stolen under their noses. And I think that's made Dr. Majila's position a lot more vulnerable as well.
And they themselves actually are recipients of loans from the same bank.
Mm.
Right. Yeah, sure. No. But the question, I'm just trying to figure out whether Nhlanhla Nene is in any way compromised by any of this, given that he was at one stage chairman of that board. The VBS loans didn't happen under his chairmanship, did they?
They happened in 2015. Nhlanhla Nene was finance minister. Before then, he was deputy minister.
Yeah.
The deals happened under him.
Mm.
So he's got a lot to answer for.
Why is he not answering?
No one has charged him with any particular thing.
Why doesn't he
thing?
Speak about it?
But why is it a bad thing to lend money?
I think that there seems to be a sort of... In science fiction, you have this sort of like magic bubble of protection that somehow sits over the PRC. And I think that's because the PRC has its finger in so many pies.
Mm.
Then maybe the powers that be are saying, we don't really want to open this can of worms and start going into each and every loan and who it was given to and whether it was properly approved and, you know, whether it's been paid back or not, or, you know. It seems to be, there could be a very, very big story in what the PRC has done.
Well, with
the
that much money around.
15 years.
There's a lot of stories. When I talk to people at the PIC or at the National Treasury, and you say, why is Daniel Majila in trouble? People say, look at the pipeline, look at the proposed pipeline and what the PIC is doing and what the PIC is not doing. When you talk to him, he says, look at the pipeline, you possibly can make up your own mind about why I'm in trouble. You talk to the people that support him, they say the same thing. You talk to the people that are trying to get rid of him, they say the same thing. Look at the pipeline, look at what the PIC is doing. There's a lot in the pipeline. There's 2 trillion rands worth of deals there at the PIC, and then there's the unlisted deals. All these politicians have their friends and they have lined them up. Others have benefited, others have not. Hence, both sides are right when those that don't want him say, look at the pipeline. Yeah, those that support him, they say, look at the pipeline.
A couple of weeks ago, you published a graph of the sort of returns of the PRC, and they were better than the market. And you sort of think, well, you know, it's one way to cover your tracks is do, you know, invest smartly.
Is the market to some extent. It's so huge. 2 trillion rand that it kind of it's forced to basically reflect what the market does. And that's what happens.
How bad the market is.
Yeah.
But you know, what they have is they have this giant unlisted fund of small investments. Now in that fund, 300 million rand of a 2 trillion rand company, they can do what they want with it.
Yeah.
You'll never notice it.
Yeah.
And that's what Sekonati says. A lot of these politicians, they know that say a 10 million rand investment, you'll never notice that in the giant context of a fund like that.
Yeah. Talking about whether what's real and what's not real, Cyril Ramaphosa goes to the Middle East. He picks up $10 billion in Saudi Arabia, another $10 billion in the United Arab Emirates. How real is this money? I mean, is it just a commitment? And you know, does Cyril obviously now has a target of $100 billion to chase over 5 years? Is he counting? I mean, he's done 20% of it already. Or is it
I think he was, you know, when the announcement was made, I don't think it was made in terms of actual landed investment, dollars arriving in South Africa. But I think that the signal from the currency market, which strengthened from where it was, I mean, it was headed for 14 Rand and is now back in the low 13s. Yeah. It seems that the market seems to think that there's some real money going to come in here. But in terms of commitments, he probably can reach that 100 billion. The question is, will they be followed through?
Will it be followed through, and will he still be around when the money arrives?
And there was absolutely no detail about what those investments are, what they will be.
Well, the Saudis were something to do with green energy, but the UAE one was completely oblique.
That's where the issue is. Yeah. You only really need to look at what the detail is. And the Saudis can come back 5-7 years later and still are thinking about where to invest the money. Is there a project that's been identified? What is the need? What have they actually bought?
Yeah.
They haven't bought.
Well, it's an opportunity, I suppose, I mean, for Ramaphosa to spell out, given the right sort of stage. This is what we're going to do with this tender that's been promised. We're going to spend 10 billion of that money there. Obviously, the stuff has got to generate some kind of return. Otherwise, it's not investment. It's a gift, which it isn't. Donald Trump in Helsinki with Vladimir Putin was hilarious.
Extraordinary.
I can't remember what he said wrong. He said something like, was it would have or wouldn't have?
Yeah.
Anyway, he backtracked on what he said about the Russians.
I think he was asked, do you believe that Russia would have interfered in our election? And what he said is, he initially said is, why would they? And then he changed it to say,
I don't think they would have.
You see, he says, I don't think they would.
And then he later said, he later called a press conference the following day to explain that I left out a little tiny few
letters. Correction.
I meant to say, I don't think they wouldn't have.
Yeah.
And because of the double negative, you know. But by then, I think the entire U.S. foreign policy
establishment had come down. He's got himself into big trouble. And I mean, I'm sure Obama yesterday knew all of that. I mean, this stuff must have come through an earpiece embedded in his ear by now. He must be able to respond to this kind of stuff almost moment by moment.
Well, he talked about politicians that lie.
Politicians that lie and politicians who hold press conferences, as you're talking about, to say nothing.
And keep lying when they've been caught in a lie. So maybe the earpiece was working.
You can close this.
Well, Donald Trump, Jacob Zuma, politicians that lie.
Yeah, all of them in Vladimir Putin's pocket.
And
too.
Barack Obama says back in the day they used to pretend they are shocked that they've been caught lying. Yeah. But then we have here our own people who actually did provide us the disclaimer many years ago. Do you remember a guy called Ndaweni Mahlangu who said, what's the problem with us lying?
There we go. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll see you again next week.